Accession number 19990, real one.
Chief Technician Roper, real one.
Can you tell me if there was a family background of military service?
Oh, yes. My father had been in the Royal Flying Corps, and he came out after the First War, but I was born in 1934. My father was in the motor trade, and we lived down in Birmingham. But in 1939, my father volunteered to go back into the Air Force. And he was too old to fly. He'd been an observer during the First War. And so he was commissioned as an engineering officer and spent most of the war responsible for the balloon barrage in Birmingham. And then when the bombing of Birmingham got too severe, the family, the children that is, were evacuated to various relatives in Leeds and in Lincoln. And my mother stayed with my father down there until he was posted in 1944. He was going to Germany to when the tide turned to keep industry running. But eventually ended up in Denmark and helped to demobilise the German Air Force in Denmark. In the meantime, my mother had come to Yorkshire, and we were retrieved from our evacuation and lived close to Bridlington. And my education was at a village school, and then eventually I went to Bridlington into a secondary school. And from there, Bridlington is a seasonal sort of place for employment. And at the age of 15, there was little prospects other than of local farming, seasonable jobs to do with the leisure industry. And many of my fellow students went into the Navy or the Air Force or the Army. And so I ended up plumping for the Army, for the Air Force, and took an entrance exam and managed to get myself to Halton in 1950.
Had you had any thoughts about a civilian occupation that would have suited you?
Not really. At school I'd joined the ATC, and I'd enjoyed going on summer camps and gliding and sort of RAF associated trips. And I think I was destined to go into the military. I mean, it might have been the Navy or the Air Force. When I decided to join, I fancied radar and sort of similar trades. But having taken the aptitude test, they quickly realised that I was a heavier, an armourer or an engine fitter, somebody who liked using a hammer rather than little tweezers. And so the aptitude test sort of channeled me into the engine fitting line.
What do you think had attracted you to the idea of working with delicate machinery like radar?
I'm not sure. I think there are certain trades that promotion is very rapid in, and you could see relatively young warrant officers in the avionics side, whereas as sort of plumbers or engine fitters, you were a bit long in the tooth before you got to warrant. And I don't know whether it was the promotional prospects or the fact that we'd been shown as ATC cadets around a lot of installations where this new technology was, and it sort of was a bit fascinating.
Now, you mentioned you were in the ATC. How long were you in it?
From, I would think, 1947 to 49, and then in 50 I went into the Air Force.
Were there other cadet corps at the school? Was there a naval force, or an army cadet force?
No. There were other schools where we could have joined their OTCs and what have you, but it was the ATC that appealed to me.
Was that, do you think, because of family influence, or was it for any other reason that you can remember?
No, not. I think... yes, possibly it would be family influence, because the Air Force was more appealing than the Army. They seemed to do sort of better things as ATC cadets than the others.
What had your father done when he was out of the Air Force?
He was in the motor trade.
Yeah.
I believe when the First War ended, he... The Air Force wanted him to go out to Iraq, or I believe that was the theatre that was active. In fact, this is where Tedder and Trenchard sort of made the Royal Air Force out in the Middle East there. But his CO wanted him to stay in and go with him to Iraq, or I think it's definitely Iraq. But he decided no. He came out and he was, I think... sort of dealing in new cars, but eventually he got onto the manufacturing side, and they manufactured boring bars and various components for cars, and had a good business until 1939, when the war came and he volunteered and went back in.
Did he encourage your interest in the Air Force directly?
Oh yes, because I don't... The business, he was sort of approaching retirement and saw no future for me in his business. My brother had followed him into the same line, but no, they, because there was no prospects at Bridlington, they encouraged me to take the exams, either for Dartmouth or for Halton, and Halton was the one I got.
Now, thinking back to the Air Training Corps, can you remember what you did in those 2 years that you were in it, what the main syllabus of training was, where the emphasis lay, if there was an emphasis?
Well, we had three ex-RAF officers as sort of CO, adjutant and chief instructor, and... because Yorkshire's got an abundance of airfields, we were able to go out to places like Driffield, along to Brough, to Blackburn Aircraft, and sort of very interesting trips. And the sort of carrot that was dangled was that there was opportunity to do gliding, which was across at Rufforth, New York. And so every weekend we used to go over and glide at Rufforth. One or two got a trips to America. In fact, I believe I got a trip to America, but had to say no because my entrance to Halton interfered with it.
What would you have done in America if you'd gone on the trip?
I think it was just a sort of familiarisation.
Would it have been visiting the United States Air Force? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely Air Force bases. There were one or two. I mean, I think one other cadet got a flying sort of scholarship and went and learnt to fly. But as I say, the going into the Air Force interfered with that, but I didn't mind.
Looking back on those days in the ATC, was the ATC a good preparation for life in the regular Air Force?
I don't think the training I received in the ATC did me any good at all, but the visits to RAF station and being shown around RAF sections, it was a good Air Force in those days, and it was that bit of it, going to the RAF dining rooms and having a nice meal, and then the sports facilities, and the sort of esprit de corps amongst the serving airmen, and that is what it was, the attraction, not the ATC itself.
So it's obvious that going on these visits, if not the ATC itself, created certain expectations?
Oh, yeah.
Like in the Royal Air Force. Were they realised, more or less?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, sort of, you don't remember the hard times, and Halton, of course, discipline was fairly strict. But the facilities were certainly there, and the esprit de corps, etc.
If I can go on now to the process of recruitment, what was the procedure by which you approached the Royal Air Force in order to become a junior aircraftsman?
I think in most of the magazines there were application forms for, or I think you could do it through your school, but I knew well before I took the entrance exam that I would where I would be going if I passed. And so whether it was the career man at the school or whether it was by application either through the ATC, because in those days if you were ex-ATC and you joined the Air Force you got a number which reflected that you were ex-ATC. Of course, Halton apprentices have a very distinctive, or had in those days, a six-figure number. And it didn't matter where you'd come from, it just went to the next number. But having applied, the exam itself, in fact, I took mine at RAF Lucas in Scotland because I was on a summer camp with the ATC and it came through and was brought up by the adjutant of the ATC squadron, and he actually invigilated it at RAF Lucas. So I think the ATC were in contact with the RAF for it to have come through that channel and not to the school.
What was actually on the exam? Do you remember what papers you had to take?
I think there was a short written paper, mainly to test English language. Then there were mathematics papers, and there were, I think, science, a little bit of sort of mechanics or physics, maths, and an English paper. And I think there was a questionnaire about your sort of intentions and your sort of previous service, previous interests and so on. And having got through that, you then were given, when you arrived, aptitude tests.
What were they like? What sort of things were
they? Well, putting square pegs in round holes and little puzzles, which were designed to test certain reflexes and abilities and so on. And, of course, you went through a medical check. I remember doing this at Hornchurch. And it was sort of quite a pleasant experience, but, of course, you were always worried that you weren't going to get through.
Did you find the written exam difficult?
Yes, quite difficult. And later it, you see, at 15 and only a secondary modern pupil, it was difficult, but you were up against other candidates who were 17 and a half and who had been to grammar school and probably already had matric and so on, and to them it was sort of a walkover. And another problem that when you got to Halton, they graded you in three grades. Well, I must have done quite well in the entrance exam because I was graded in the top grade at 15 years and 9 months. And I was there amongst a lot of quite bright pupils, whereas it might have been better had I been graded in the third grade, which meant that you needed more sort of refresher, if you like, because I found that keeping up with some of the 17-year-olds was too difficult. And during the first, I think I, after about a year, I had to be recoursed by 8 months.
to catch up. A remedial course.
Yeah, after the first year. But technically, there was no problems. But on the educational side, and of course, one of the problems was that they made everybody go for national certificate, whereas it might have been better for the brighter to have been pushed as high as they could go, whereas the less with less aptitude should have been given, well, in this day and age, GCEs or what have you, so that you got the highest sort of award, well, highest grade of what you were capable of, rather than what they thought you might have been.
Well, presumably, though, they were trying to use the course not only for training but also assessment. And
oh, yes, yeah.
So they'd have been sort of sifting everyone all the way mm-hmm. through. What about the medical? Was that a rigorous medical?
Quite stiff. In fact, I think, occasionally you got people that were sort of told to come back in 8 months' time or next year and so on, but... no, it was quite a stiff medical, yes.
Did they concentrate on any particular aspects of health in the medical, or was it sort of really a general?
No, I think it was. I mean, they examined you physically, they checked your hearing, eyesight, the normal routine stuff.
What about your state of physical fitness at the time?
That didn't seem to trouble them, because when the course started, of course, you got regular, exercise, and I mean it was sport orientated and drill orientated for the first year. They certainly made you fit.
Mm. Were you fit anyway when you went in?
I wouldn't have. Said no. I wasn't particularly fit. I couldn't run hundreds of yards, and I hadn't excelled in any particular sport. Although I was an active youngster.
So you were, you know, you had no serious medical problems, and you were basically fit.
Yep.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the aptitude tests. Were any of these, as far as you know, psychometric as opposed to practical?
Probably. The thing with tests in the Air Force, I mean, if they want six trombone players and you want to be something or other, and they give you a test, you have passed out as a trombone player, and you never know whether the demand for that particular trade is greater than the one you asked for. Or whether the aptitude test is really designed to put you in the right slot.
Were you ever in danger of becoming a trombone player?
No.
So you passed the tests and you got the medical. Presumably the next thing was you had to go and report to Halton. Was that
yes.
when you were inducted?
Yes.
What happened during that process of induction in the first few days?
Well, you arrived, you were in civilian sort of clothes, and you arrived... you were given joining instructions, and you were told the times of the trains from Baker Street to Wendover. And you found yourself on a train with a lot of other youngsters, and eventually you ambled off the train in Wendover, and there was usually a sergeant who marched you to Halton, which was 2.5 miles. He'd get you into some sort of thing and take you up to the camp. And I seem to remember going into a wooden gymnasium building on the side of the square and actually being attested, taking the oath of allegiance. And then we were taken to sort of split into groups and taken to a barrack block and shown where our bed was. And I think we were allowed to sort of, because we'd been travelling, allowed to get ourselves smartened up and then taken for a meal and settled down for our first night in the RAF, only to be disturbed by a senior sort of mob who came round saying, "You are going to work for me." Sort of, there was a fagging system. And it was allowed to a certain extent, but you got the senior entry round, and usually one individual would say, "You're mine, my name is so and so, you will come and sort my boots out at 6 o'clock tomorrow night." And then there was an exciting sort of couple of days while you went down and got kitted out, and your uniforms were sort of given you, and you went to the tailor's shop and put them on, and he'd come round with a piece of French chalk saying, "We need 6 inches off that sleeve and 3 inches off the other one," to try and get you it to fit. And of course, being young men of sort of 15 and 16, some of them were growing at the rate of about a foot a week, you know, so it was a funny business. But
did you find the uniform comfortable?
Oh yes, yeah. We were fortunate because we had boots and shoes, but the boots could be a bit of a problem to start with. And wearing a tie, the rough collars, because they had in those days both the best uniform and the working dress had very rough material. And it used to make your neck sore, and of course the collars were very stiff. So a few of us that weren't used to stiff collars and sort of hairy jackets suffered a little bit, but nothing to speak of.
What about the boots? How long did it take you to get used to wearing those without discomfort?
Well, the problem was that you spent hours polishing them, and the boots usually ended up for parades only, and for inspections only, because we had a kit layout, and your boots were part of it. I think shoes, I seem to remember, we probably had working boots and a pair of shoes, and the shoes were quite comfortable. But we had an awful lot of square bashing to do, so it soon sort of got your feet in trim.
Did you ever do any route marches as part of that early training?
I can't remember any, no. I mean, for the first year you spent square bashing and basic training, physical training and gas warfare and all this sort of thing you had to go through.
Did you do any basic infantry training while you were doing that first year?
Well, no. I mean, we did rifle drill and we went on the ranges with rifle, yeah. But I wouldn't have said it was the type of infantry drill that you're sort of intimating.
Now, another thing that often makes a powerful first impression, besides the change of clothing, is the accommodation. What was that like?
It was good. They were barrack blocks with six rooms and central sort of ablutions, etc. There was one bunk outside the barrack room where a permanent staff, this is a regular airman, lived. And then inside the barrack block, there was a bunk in the corner where either a corporal apprentice or sergeant apprentice lived.
A senior boy,
not of your own entry until you became very senior, but it was usually from either an intermediate entry. You see, in each, there's an entry into Halton every 4 months, and in your particular squadron you would have your entry, the entry that, in my case, there was the 66th, the 63rd and the 60th entry. Now, when I got there, the 58th entry were the senior entry on the whole station, but my senior entry in my particular squadron was the 60th, and then we had the intermediate that had done a year before we got there, which was the 63rd. And they were now becoming promoted to corporals, and they were the sort of people that you had in the bunk inside your room. And you might, if there wasn't an RAF senior NCO living in the outer bunk, you'd have probably had one of the senior entry in the outer bunk, with 60th entry in the outer bunk, which we had actually a sergeant apprentice from the 60th.
So these would be boys who'd be what, 2 years or so older than you? Or
well, the corporal in the room, the 63rd chap, would be at least a year older, probably 18 months, and in the outer room, the senior entry would be 2 to 2.5 years older.
Did this system of internal cadet government work well?
Oh, yes. I used to have to fag for one of the 58th entry, who was the senior entry, and when they left, I mean, they helped you out. They gave you their old textbooks, and they sort of showed you the ropes a little bit. I mean, you still had to make their bed or do whatever they wanted, but it was... I didn't disagree with it, you know.
It sounds like it was a reasonable exchange of favours rather than...
Yeah, I mean, you had a little bit of protection from other outside forces. You know, if you were sort of assigned to one particular man, then you could sort of say, I'm sorry, but I'm working for so-and-so, and it protected you from some of the others.
What number of cadets would there be in the barrack room?
Each room would have, I would think, 18 to 20 in a room. We were fortunate that we had regular beds. When I first went there, the beds were these half beds that you pulled out. It sort of had a join in the middle and came out stretched. We were lucky we also had mattresses, whereas a lot of them had sort of three biscuits, as they call them.
The choir mat.
Yeah, we had, at the foot of the bed, you had a large wooden box. And above your head, end of the bed, there was a steel locker with two shelves and a drawer. And the doors on this steel locker were always open. Your webbing was suitably assembled and hung on two coat hooks. There were clothes hooks underneath. And your webbing hung on those. And then you had a vest and a shirt and so on, and your best uniform, all folded and on display permanently, this was. And once a week or once a month, you had a full kit inspection, and everything had to be laid out on the bed. And, you know, there was nowhere... you weren't allowed civilian clothing, so any possessions you had that weren't sort of RAF or job related were kept in a case room, but these were regularly searched because, of course, there was no smoking, no motorbikes, no going out with girls unless you had a chip from your mother to say it was all right. You know, unbelievable in this day and age, but... and certainly no civilian clothing. If they caught you with civilian clothing, you were for the high jump. It was impounded and you were given it to take home when you next had a chance.
Another thing you mentioned as being part of the initial impression is being taken for a meal. What did you think of the food?
It wasn't good, but we weren't used to particularly good food anyway. Even in the 1950s, food wasn't as plentiful as it is today. And we used to get an awful lot of porridge. You sometimes got cornflakes, but to put on them, you had watered-down milk that had been sweetened, which that was the treat for Sundays. There was a lot of greengage jam, which was put out on a communal plate in the centre. We had sort of tables which had benches at the side, which housed about 10, 5 at each side. And you would have a butter floating in water to keep it sort of solid, squares of butter. And, of course, you were only allowed so much. Rationing was still on. And so each man was allowed two slices of bread a day or an ounce of cheese and so on. And, we got adequate food, and sometimes you could have extra, particularly if people didn't like it. There was a lot of pom, and they used to mix the cheese with the pom, so you got a sort of...
What's pom?
You'd call it smash these days, but it was sort of powdered potato, which you just added water to.